Hello and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. In the 18th century, Paris was known as the City of Light. By the end of the 20th century, it was where Claire McFarlane was almost extinguished after she was raped, beaten, and left for dead. It took her 16 years to get justice from a French court, and she had to foot the bill. At the end of it, her ordeal brought her a new mission, a four-year worldwide beach run to inspire survivors and the organizations that serve them. Month 8 finds her here in Hawaii and in this morning this in our studio. Hi there.
Hi, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you.
It's wonderful to be here.
I can imagine. I mean, knowing what you have been through, to be in a place where you not only have safety but the ability to influence others who will be able to help people like you, who have had such a horrendous and unthinkable, unimaginable ordeal. I don't want to have you relive all of that because you've probably had to do that enough over the last many years. But as you're now traveling the world, running on beaches and talking with organizations and other women who have survived, what are you finding most that you're carrying with you from country to country?
It's a really good question. It's been an eye-opening journey, and U.S. soil is country 17, so I'm only very much at the beginning of the journey, but I've already seen so much and heard so many different kinds of stories. There's a very common thread when it comes to sexual violence, and that's the taboo and the silence that really shrouds it. There's a real fear to talk about, and I think survivors carry a lot of guilt and blame. So that's something I see everywhere. Other than that, I'm seeing quite a lot of difference, and some countries have surprised me. I went to Malaysia just recently. I was there probably about a month ago, and I was blown away by the services they provide in their hospitals, which is somewhere where I hadn't expected to see something like that. So it's been a very interesting journey so far.
And heartening from what you've just said about what you didn't expect to find in a certain place around the world. But when you look at where Hawaii is, you've been talking to organizations on Maui. Have you been surprised with what we do or don't do here?
I suppose it's quite interesting. I was in Maui for a week, and I've already heard stories from about 10 survivors, and half of those survivors didn't even know about the existence of the services in Maui, which for me really stood out as sort of a gap or a breakdown in awareness. However, meeting with the services, it's been great to see that there's a really large amount of services available, an extremely proactive system. So when someone does reach out for help, they don't necessarily have to report the crime, but they can still get help. And I suppose that's where I would see a need for improvement in Maui and maybe potentially around the islands of Hawaii, is that people know that they have got services available to them, and it doesn't always mean that they have to go out and be involved in the criminal justice system. They can still get help.
The idea of having a system that is more survivor-centered is one that we talk about a lot as we look at those people who have been victimized by others in a sexual context. And looking at that through that lens, as you've only obviously been in 17 countries, but other places where you have talked to NGOs and survivors and just kept your ear to the ground, is there a way of being able to, in that limited context, pen where we are now in being truly survivor-centered?
That's the journey has been that for me, which has been really important, is coming at it from the perspective of a survivor. I walked the road, I think, the full journey of being a survivor of rape, from the actual attack itself, through the medical process, through the forensics, through the police involvement, then not catching him and then catching him years later through DNA and then throwing through a justice system, and faced constant beating and almost like being You know, at times I say I was interrogated by the system. I never felt like I was treated as a victim or this lack of kindness. And unfortunately, I still see that happening everywhere. We tend to forget about the victim in the process, and, you know, it becomes more about the outcome or getting a criminal outcome in court. And the victim's isn't a human anymore. They become this object in a process. And I think that that's what, for me, this journey has been really important, is to walk through and see through the eyes of a survivor where the system is really helping and where there's some real needs and gaps. You know, I've already seen here in my time in Hawaii and the US with regards to how funding works. And sadly, I think that does fail the victim.
How so?
Well, from what I understand, the funding process is a 3 to 4 year process, which means that an organization that receives funding, they have 3 or 4 years to use it. Then they actually have to resubmit an application, and everyone has to do that. And there's no guarantee that it's the same organization that will get the funding. So what that means is that if they're providing services to survivors of sexual violence, which will involve all sorts of services, there might be medical support, advocacy through court, counseling, that organization stops doing that in their local area and someone else does it. And that creates a real breakdown because people don't know who's doing what, and then even the public has no idea where they need to go.
That seems to argue for better networking among organizations and to really see how many overlaps there are that might be disentangled, or to be able to use whatever funds are available in the most comprehensive way. We only have a couple more minutes to spend with you. Is there something that you think that we need to hear beyond what we've just talked about concerning victims of rape and healing from all of that, which clearly this has become for you? Is there a message that you want to leave us with?
Yeah, definitely. It was a question that got asked to me in the Solomon Islands. I actually shared my story with the public prosecution and defense lawyers as a form of informal training, and we opened the floor up to any kind of question. And they asked the question about when the story from a victim changes, from when they interviewed immediately by the police and then maybe the next day or a couple of days later the story might change. And it was for them it was a great deal of confusion, and they tended to doubt the victim's story. And that sparked for me something that's really important in a message, is that the trauma from sexual violence is extremely traumatic. I don't think anyone on earth wants that to happen to them. And it shakes your world, and you're trying to cope and survive in the first few hours. And so that the message is that it's going to be different for everyone, and it's not linear. So it's going to change. And that's part of the healing as well.
I want to wish you all the best as you continue your journey, and stay in touch with us and let us know how you find other policies around the world as you're talking to other NGOs and other countries. And we'll plan to talk with you as you move through that.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Claire McFarlane is a rape survivor and founder of Footsteps to Inspire. Her mission is to run more than 3,000 kilometers of beach across 184 countries to support survivors of sexual violence and to raise awareness.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, a celebration of Ireland's master poet, William Butler Yeats. But first, your quiz. Mau, o ka ho'olawe, o Hawaii.
Later in the hour, we'll hear about the rollout of Bike Share. So today's Backyard Quiz centers on one of Hawaii's most famous events that incorporates cycling, the Ironman Triathlon. Although other triathlons were already being held elsewhere in the world, the Ironman was the first in Hawaii. It was created from several, or rather it was the creation of several endurance athletes living in Oahu after the 1977 running of the Oahu Perimeter Relay Road Race. A friendly argument arose between members of two clubs, the Mid-Pacific Runners and the Waikiki Swim Club. At issue was which type of athlete was more fit, runners or swimmers. A number of U.S. Navy athletes on the scene had completed triathlons in California, and one suggested a triathlon to settle the matter here. That race combined three existing contests, a well-known bike race, a swim race, and a run to create Hawaii's first triathlon. Today's question, can you name all three of those single races? And as you're listening to the rebroadcast of the conversation, we won't be taking any calls to answer the backyard quiz, but you can always call us at 11 a.m. when we're live. And if you want to see your prize, just have a look on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
The bard at the ancient traditions of the British Isles was a storyteller, a maker of songs and poems, and a performer, the voice of his country's history, culture, and guiding spirit. It's a tradition that's been kept alive in Ireland down through the years, embodied in modern times by its great poet, William Butler Yeats. Patrick Ball is a contemporary performer on the Celtic harp who weaves stories, poems, and songs into his performances. He's coming to UH this weekend with a program called Come Dance With Me in Ireland, Encounters with W.B. Yeats. We talked yesterday about the bardic tradition.
Well, I think that the bard was probably more important than people give him credit for, because most people nowadays, bards are simply people that tell stories, and in the earlier times wandered around. But the bard and the poet and the storyteller, that sort of thing, were very, very highly honored people.
Yeah.
Back in the earliest times, in what they called the bardic order, they had the poet was just below the kings or the chieftains, and they their entire job was simply to compose poetry and celebrate genealogies and things. But the poets didn't even bother to recite anything. That was handed over to the bard, and the bard recited all the pieces of poetry and historical eulogies and all these sort of things. Mm-hmm. So they were essentially the keepers of the culture, and it was an enormously important part, particularly because the Irish, actually, even till now, really, find that the best way of passing on anything was from person to person. And just to hearken back to the music that I play, almost all the old music of Ireland is gone and lost forever, the old harp music, because mm-hmm. when the last master of the wire-strung harp, which is what I play, died, all the old music died with him or her. And so the bard kept that sort of stuff alive for many, 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 many centuries until things broke down.
The poet that you celebrate in this program is very much in the tradition of the bard. Do you agree?
Absolutely.
Yeats,
Yeats. Well, Yeats was very, very deeply steeped in the earliest times in Ireland. And he was always trying to find his way into what he considered the mystical realm of Ireland. I mean, a lot of people think he was a bit of a nutcase because he pursued the occult and he attended seances all his life.
Yeah.
But, you know, no matter how you feel about that sort of thing, the reason that he did it was that he wanted to find his way into the mystical realms, the world of fairy in Ireland. And to him, it wasn't just some sort of kooky thing. He believed that Ireland had a real spirit and a soul, and he wanted to find his way into it so that he could not only experience it, but to write about it as well. And it's all throughout his poetry. So, and he believed that the bard had particular powers to find their way into that mystical realm. So what I got more wrapped up in was that, you know, particularly when he was a younger man, he used to wander around the countryside with a lady by the name of Lady Gregory, and they would chat with the peasantry, all the country people. And back in those times, storytelling was still practiced and a force, and people believed in the fairies and the other world. And he used to wander around through the countryside, and he would gather all these ancient stories about the other world, and or perhaps the oversoul. And so he was deeply steeped in that sort of thing. And so the poetry, there's so much of his poetry. There's far more than any one person could probably come to grips with. But yeah, the part that I tended to focus on was his poetry, which dealt with, you know, as he called them, the good people or the fairy people.
Mm-hmm. And you are performing on the Celtic harp as you read his poetry, or how does that integrate into the show?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing you should ask. I don't want to go into this too long, but when we applied for this fellowship, this other guy and myself, our proposal was we wanted to study the relationship between Yeats and the Celtic Renaissance and, as they call it, the clarshuck, the wire-strung Celtic harp, which was what I play. Mm-hmm. And we ended up finding out that there was essentially no relationship there because Yeats, to the best of everybody's knowledge, seemed to be entirely tone deaf.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. He didn't really understand anything about music, but he was deeply involved in the theater. He, among others, established the National Theater of Ireland, the Abbey Theater. Mm-hmm. And occasionally he would want music in the plays. And the one thing that he hated more than anything was for anybody to put his poetry to music.
Is that right?
As lyrics. It just drove him insane. He hated it. And people do it all the time now. Yeah. And they've done beautiful work. But I don't know if they're aware that Yeats would probably tie them on an anthill for doing it. But but anyway, he had no sense of music or anything, and so he would be giving these instructions to the musicians, and the musicians would think he was a total nutcase because he didn't know what he was talking about. But he had an almost supernatural sense of rhythm and the sound of words, because he believed, and it's not always apparent in his poetry, but he believed that the sound of the words not only revealed the deepest part of his poetry, but he believed that the sound of the words was actually a doorway into the mystical realm of Ireland.
I'm so surprised to hear that, because I think he's among the most musical of poets.
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
You know, and I will arise now and go to Innisfree.
It's just beautiful.
You don't have to know what it means.
Be loud glades. Yeah, he was just an extraordinary character. And all the peasantry around Coole Park, where he lived sometimes with Lady Gregory, said that they used to watch him. He'd be walking along the country lanes of Ireland, and they said specifically that he sounded like a hive of bees because he'd be walking along intoning his poetry because he wanted to get the sound exactly the way he wanted it. So I don't think it's necessary to be aware of the fact that he did this, but I think it's almost inevitable that anybody that hears his poetry spoken is captivated by the sound of it, even though they're not aware of it. It's the sound of it that gives it its power and beauty.
Well, I'm reminded, and we should make a reference to the sound of the Celtic harp, because that's very much a part of your upcoming performance. Let's hear just a little sample of that, if we could.
Thank you.
a fantastically deep range to that instrument, from bass to treble, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. It's 4.5 octaves, but it's really one of the most unique instruments I've ever heard. It was played in Ireland 1,000 years ago, mm-hmm. and it was their beloved instrument. It was very, very important to the culture, and it died out completely 200 years ago. They switched to playing harps with gut strings, and that's when almost all the old music died away. But it's the most extraordinary thing. It's strung with brass wire, all monofilament brass wire, and the low notes are, the strings themselves must be close to 3.5 feet long. And so when you pluck on these things, not only is it a very deep sound, but it rings. It would probably be, if I plucked on it right in the studio now, it would probably be ringing by next Wednesday. And part of the technique of playing it in the old style was not just to pluck the strings, but they resonates for so long that you'd have a separate finger pattern which would come along and dampen a string that you wanted to mute, because as the melody went on, the chord that you chose wouldn't be appropriate.
At some point, you have to stop them.
Yes, you do.
Patrick Ball will perform Come Dance With Me in Ireland, Encounters with W.B. Yeats, in the University of Hawaii at Manoa's Orvis Auditorium on Saturday evening. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, now accepting applications for summer school featuring camps on drone photography and filmmaking for girls and boys in preschool through grade 12. SacredHearts.org.
Today we pick up an ongoing reality check, the abuse case of toddler Peyton Valiente. Attorney General Douglas Chin is expected to speak at a press conference in the noon hour. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the reasons why. Aloha.
Happy Aloha Friday, but it's a somber occasion, but maybe some justice coming for Peyton. Just to recap, because it's been a little while since we've reported this story, first broken by our John Hill at Civil Beat. Peyton was 17 months old. This was back in 2015. And he was essentially assaulted in an Eva Beach daycare. That is the strong evidence. Bruises on the back, bleeding in his eyes, classic signs of abuse.
This is brain injury.
And yet, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Remember we talked about how the doctors actually cut out part of his skull in order to relieve pressure on his brain. And, I mean, the good news is that Peyton survived, but he did almost die from those injuries.
So, Chad, what made the AG want to review this case?
Well, there seemed to be, well, first of all, Keith Conoscero, the city prosecutor, declined to take up the case. Even though HPD had done some new investigating, Conoscero did not feel there was enough evidence. But apparently, the AG does think there is something there, and hopefully we're going to hear more about what he has to say about that. Certainly, Senator Will Aspero, and Eva Beach is in his district, he thinks that there is some evidence here, and he actually urged Conoscero and then later Chin to take this up again. It is rare, it appears, for the AG to take over a local criminal case, but there seems to be enough compelling evidence to do this. We haven't heard yet from the AG about that.
Well, that's what we'll wait to hear in about an hour's time, and then to see if there is potentially any new evidence or a way in which they're looking at the current evidence. But, a really difficult case for any, I think, loving parent to hear about.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Chad. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us today from Civil Beat with a reality check. And as this is a Friday, as we always do, we want to take a look at what's happening in our newsroom, what we can expect to hear as we go into next week. To help us with that, HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, joins us now. Hi there.
Aloha, Beth Ann. Always a lot to talk about on a Friday looking ahead. One thing, the architecture school at UH has an interesting project going on. This is including various reimaginings of the lower campus at UH Manoa, and there can be a lot of imagination put to work there. But there are
more than just a facelift.
Exactly. Three different draft plans. Each one includes a rail stop. So, you know, this is something looking at the future. One includes a 35,000-seat stadium, all kinds of stuff. So Noe Tanigawa is going to take a look at some of these and let the imagination run a little bit as continues to happen with the Honolulu Biennial around town through early May. Noe also is keeping track of that and various. She does these, I sort of think of them as like audio posters of different parts of the biennial.
Well, it'll be interesting to see those architecture plans for the lower campus at UH Manoa and to see if there's going to be some dollars. will there be dollars following that beautiful idea, whatever emerges?
Start with a vision.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. While we're talking about vision, at the Ledge, we're looking at potential help for seniors this year in ways that we haven't necessarily seen before.
It's true. We're going to see what comes out of this. As you know, legislature in recess a couple of days next week. Very busy time behind the scenes, that winnowing process, second crossover Thursday. So any bills passed in one chamber that have crossed over to the other need to get through their third reading on that side to go back to the original chamber, which is very procedural, but it's one of those key watermarks. Meanwhile, coming next week is Kapuna Power Day on Thursday, a rally at the Capitol and a focus on some of the legislative priorities really for seniors, for what is left and what may go ahead this session. So Wayne Yoshioka will be on that one.
And I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about what's happening in the music scene, a big name coming to town.
Carlos Santana, names don't get much bigger than that. Coming back to Hawaii, some shows on Oahu and Maui, talking to Dave Lawrence. Another name that's big to a lot of folks in the music industry, David Bromberg, playing guitar. Number of amazing people he's played with, Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, recorded with all these folks. And he's going to be on three islands, actually. And Dave's going to be talking with him as well.
A lot to look forward to next week. Thanks for the preview.
You bet.
HPR's news director, Bill Dorman. And if you listen to this program consistently, you know another Friday thing we do is to take a look at your emails, comments, and what's come over our talkback line. This week, we heard this.
I'm Lawrence from Ho'opuloa. I'm calling about Nanette Napoleon and her attempts to retrieve Hawaiian artifacts overseas. Just one addendum. There are a lot of Hawaiian artifacts in private hands on the Big Island that could be recovered and do need protection. I'm speaking specifically of property developers, land developers, property management firms. If you go into almost any office here, you will find Hawaiian artifacts recovered during the construction process that are not being stewarded very well. Thank you. Bye.
After Monday's story on how much beachgoers would be willing to pay for cleaner oceans, Andrea DaCosta tweeted us, maybe the better question is, who has the right to make choices about how the beaches and oceans are used? It seems polluters are running the show.
Following Tuesday's segment on Equal Pay Day, Anthony Pignataro on Maui tweeted, the gender pay gap segment of this edition of The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio is outstanding.
After yesterday's Town Square discussion on Honolulu's sit and lie ban, Marlo Mitty commented on Facebook, thank you for this discussion. It's so sad in one of the richest countries in the world that we haven't solved this yet and we allow people to live in these conditions.
Thanks for all the feedback and kind words. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter. Or you can call us on our talkback line, 792-8217. The last time we talked with Ben Trevino, he had a plan and an idea of what he'd need to roll it out. The concept for a transportation alternative used in other places, over 1,200 of them worldwide, in fact, provided a model for Hawaii. With the recent announcement of this summer's opening of bike share stands stretching from Urban to East Honolulu, we thought it was time to catch up to him before he had to jump on a bike. We sat down with him in our studio to get a deeper look at how the addition of the service would change policy for everyone who uses the road.
First and foremost, we're excited. I think we're excited to have a start date on the calendar and know that by the time school starts this year, that we'll have a fully functioning bike share system up and running. So I think that's the biggest thing. And then now reflecting on how much or maybe how little time we have between now and launch, there's a long list of things that we want to do to introduce everyone to bike share and the things they need to know. And so one of those big things is education. And I think we want people to really feel comfortable with the idea that even if you haven't ridden a bike, that you might be using the Beaky system yourself. You know, we like to think there's a little bit of something for everybody in Beaky. And so one of our major pushes over the next few months is going to be partnering with the Hawaii Bicycling League on educational seminars, rider clinics, and then safety and road rules and all the things that I think make people uncomfortable or that people need to be comfortable to ride on the road. And so we're going to be really pushing hard to communicate all those things and let people get comfortable.
A road that technically is supposed to be shared by all anyway, but we know that there have been many issues surrounding that for some time, and how we all share that road is really important to everybody else's safety too. In bringing together a system like this, which is in other places, and you've got some track records to look at though, do you see this as being any different for Hawaii in the fact that we are a very small place, we're a very small and congested place, and getting ever more so? And for people who need to get short-term transportation, that this offers a different kind of opportunity for them than just, you know, either hopping on a bus or walking?
Yeah, actually, I think that's a great question, you know, and one of the things that we have learned in looking at bike share cities around the country and around the world is that every city is a little different, and our transportation environment being what it is, I think there are some very clear advantages to being smaller. Actually, one of the things that's nice about the compact footprint of urban Honolulu is that you can make most trips that you need to make in under 2 miles, you know, once you get into town. Then if you need to meet somebody for lunch, if you need to go to the Capitol to go to a hearing, if you want to go to a meeting downtown, all those trips are very short and can be done in 15 minutes on a bike, which is why I think bike share is so attractive in this area. That's one aspect of it. I think the other aspect of it is the limited space that we have in terms of the street and sidewalks, the right-of-ways, and space to put stations. You know, I think one of the things that we've run into as we've planned the system is, do we have, you know, are there good places to put these stations so that they're the Beaky stops, we're calling them, so that people can find them. And and we've done a lot of community outreach, talked to a lot of folks in the community, and there are concerns. You know, I think we saw that with the King Street cycle track. People are trying to adjust. How do we best use our resources so that they come together in a transportation system that best serves everyone? You know, I think people that are on the sidewalk, sidewalk users are often some of our older and more vulnerable users. You know, you talked about safety, and I think that's one of the major concerns of people on the sidewalk. And we are very sensitive to those concerns. And one of the things that we want to do with bike share is deploy it in a way that enhances the safety of the overall system.
And hopefully means that people will not be riding their bikes on the sidewalk.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I think that we would love for everyone to have their own place, you know, a place that's appropriate for their mode of transportation. I think that's one of the main objectives of the city's Complete Streets effort.
Clearly, you're happy with the way it turned out for bikes and for what you'll be able to access with bike share. Is there something more that you think that needs to be brought into the discussion that hasn't been so far?
Well, I think Complete Streets opens up the discussion to all the important issues. You know, the things that typically I think are important in transportation but don't often get talked about are, again, safety You know, our transportation system, I think we should assume as a baseline that our transportation system is going to get everyone where they need to go safely. You know, I think we should never accept that serious injuries or fatalities that are involved in collisions should be something that we accept as a community. And Complete Streets, I think, starts that conversation. Are our intersections safe? Are the speeds that people are traveling safe? Are the conflicts that are introduced in different modes, are they safe? And then I think the other thing is equity. As someone who has owned and operated a car, I admit to seeing the world through the lens of a car owner, right? And I look to the city and the municipal government to provide me with the infrastructure and facilities I need to drive my car around, right? And if that includes fixing potholes or making sure that the traffic runs efficiently and effectively, those are things that I look to my city to provide. But cars are very expensive vehicles. You know, I think not everyone can afford a car. And one of the things that we are trying to do with Bike Share is provide people affordable transportation. But part of that equation is looking to the city for the same things, facilities that allow people to get around no matter what their mode of transportation is. And I think bicycling has a number of community benefits. That's why we're doing it. Obviously, it's our project. So we, you know, Bike Share Y cares a lot about bike share and bicycling as a mode. And we think it's an essential part. In a way, I've always thought of it as the tip of the spear for a multimodal reality.
A catalyst, perhaps, to what we've been talking about with bikes and bike lanes for the last 30 years.
Exactly. Yeah. Bike Share provides people the access they need to try this out. You know, if you can use a bike for one trip in your day, it doesn't have to be to commute, it doesn't have to be for 80% of your trip, but if you can use it for one trip in a day, I think that's enough to transform people's perspectives on how they get around their city and what's possible.
After you have this up and running in the core, in the Honolulu core, where do you want to go next? Any place else on Oahu you have targeted?
We've looked at a lot of communities. I think every community can use some amount of bike sharing. Not every system will be the same because there's different density profiles and different opportunities from a funding and financing standpoint. But I think one of the places it really makes sense is the North Shore and Haleiwa communities. You know, there's a lot of restrictions on transportation along the highway where there's, you know, one lane in each direction, and often it gets crowded with events. And so being able to provide bike access in an off-street way so that residents and visitors can move around and get around the congestion, I think, is a really valuable thing that we can provide to that community. I think Kailua is another great bicycling community. I know that the bicycles in Kailua and the tourist activity in Kailua has given residents concern. But I think Bike Share is a way to start to alleviate some of the gridlock. You know, I think the more people are on bikes, probably the better. And so if people are going to be there either way, making an efficient use of the roads and the situation in Kailua could probably be good. So I think those are areas that we would like to look into.
Ben Trevino, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Bethan.
Ben Trevino is the president and COO of Bike Share Hawaii. He also did a stint with the University of Hawaii Economic Research Organization, where he was the architect of the UHERO Dashboard Project. Bike Share Hawaii rolls out this summer. A link to the map of the planned stations is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking at the history of Hawaii's most famous sporting event, the Ironman Triathlon. We told you the story of the race's origin and asked you to name the three separate races that were combined to create Hawaii's first triathlon. Most triathlons, then and now, are much shorter than the Ironman, which consists of a 2.4-mile swim, a 112-mile bike ride, and a 26.2-mile road run. Definitely not for the faint of heart or body. So much so that as the inaugural event was being organized in 1977, U.S. Navy Commander John Collins, who was one of the event's organizers, said, "Whoever finishes first, we'll call him the Iron Man." And the name was born. Now, those three distances may seem somewhat random, and to some extent they are. That's because the first Ironman used the courses of three separate races, which were the Honolulu Marathon, the Waikiki Rough Water Swim, and the Around Oahu Bike Race.
And Todd Sells called us from North Shore in Wailua, knew the answer. We also heard from Scott Sagum, who called in from Kauai. He was one of the first participants back in 1981 when it was called the Nautilus International Triathlon. Thanks very much for calling in and letting us know that you're listening and that you knew the answer. Todd will get the prize, though. And if you have a quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com.
We've become a society that disposes of its trash all too freely, turning the world into a mess that future generations will struggle to clean up. On Maui, The Art of Trash is an annual 3-week art exhibit showcasing works made out of materials that would ordinarily be discarded. And it's amazing to see just how exciting the results can be. Wilma Nakamura is the founder of Sharing Aloha, one of the sponsoring organizations for Maui Art of Trash, and she's on the line with us now. Thanks for joining us, Wilma.
Thanks for having me.
Well, sure. Does this event seems to get bigger every year? Is that what's been happening this year?
Yes. We have, I think Facebook is absolutely amazing. We used to do it by paper, you know, and the results are way better with Facebook. So, yeah, we hardly do any kind of paper advertising anymore. It's everything online.
It's a social media world, isn't it, Wilma?
I know. Crazy.
Well, we might as well turn it to our advantage, right? How many artists have you got participating this year?
Well, we have 65 pieces, but some of the artists have more than one, and so I would say we have about 50 artists participating.
Well, that's pretty impressive, I would think. And I've seen
every year, you know, it's a different group. It's not the same old, same old.
Well, so you just let them throw through Facebook, and then what? They submit their work to you, and do you have a judge and jury for this?
We do have a juror. Judy Bruder this year was the sole juror, and she looked at all of the pieces and elected, you know, 65 pieces. And yeah, really exciting, very, very innovative show. And they're really made of trash, you know, plastic found in the ocean, old things that don't work, old popcorn poppers or hot water appliances and, you know, things like that, old broken windshield wipers. So they're given another life, and unless you're looking very closely, you wouldn't know what they were. So, yeah, really gives other people ideas, too, of what they can do.
I would think that each year's event would build on the previous year in terms of making people think, oh, yeah, we can actually do that. And well, for example, Wilma, I'm looking at a bufo that consists of two rusted wheelbarrows piled one on top of the other with eyes and little bufo feet. It's really kind of impressive.
I know, and didn't it take you a while to figure out they were wheelbarrows?
It did. It didn't, but I knew it was a bufo right away, so, you know, what does that tell you? It's really an effective and
Yeah, you know, when she's during the show, she's also looking for the transformation of material. So when you look at it, if you see two wheelbarrows first, that kind of isn't, you know, a successful piece as much as what you saw first was a buffo. And yeah, it rusted in the right places too.
Yeah, no, I'm really not sure how the artists created the legs and the feet, but it's remarkably effective. It looks like it's ready to jump out at you.
Yeah, and the eyes, I think the eyes lit up. It went on and off, you know, it was kind of hilarious.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah, now, you see, that guy has not entered again.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the group changes. Somebody will come up with a brilliant idea, and then we think, oh, you know, this is, he'll come back. No, haven't seen them again. But, yeah, which is exciting for me because I see completely new blood a lot of times. So.
Well, I mean, that the buffo artist may just have gone on to international success because I see a lot of work, you know, at the Whitney Biennale that looks as if it's made of trash anyway. It's almost a new genre within the world of art.
Yeah, yeah, you know, cheap material. So, and in Hawaii, that's how you know you have a sense of place with this show because so much of the pieces are made from beach trash, you know.
Sure.
Plastic, yeah, sure. Floating in the water. So,
do you see this event kind of expanding awareness of recycling and the need to do something about the things we discard?
I don't know about recycling. I think that more people are the audience that I see and that, you know, the audience that want to come up and tell me about what they're doing with their so-called trash. I think it builds, as you say, and, you know, it's giving other, I think it gives permission to other people, you know, like your grandfather was probably making something that you thought, oh, please, just throw that away, you know. But
it's a different mentality, Wilma. Thanks very much for talking with us. Wilma Nakamura is the founder of Sharing Aloha, one of the sponsoring organizations for Maui Art of Trash, which opens tonight at 6 p.m. at Maui Mall Center Stage in Kahului.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, Hawaii Pacific University, and Ulupono Initiative.
Well, it's Friday, and that means it's time to start thinking about what we're going to do with our weekend. And it's always good to hear about events going on for free. And our colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that are under the radar. And, Derek, there's a free hands-on art activities tomorrow. That's where is that, on Oahu?
Yes, that's taking place at the Hawaii State Art Museum from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. They have monthly projects, and this month's project is called Ready, Set, Go, Design, Build, Draw. Build with blocks and then draw an abstract picture of the blocks. Free hands-on make and take for all ages, so drop in anytime between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. at High Sam downtown and allow about 30 minutes to complete a project. All materials are provided.
That's quite a hectic pace. Design, build, and draw all in 30 minutes.
But
But if you can do it, you can do it, right?
I think it can be done, yes.
Well, let's hope so. Mm-hmm. And at Pahoa, there's a celebration of community, culture, and the environment. That's tomorrow.
Yes, the Arts and Sciences Center in Pahoa presents the second annual Tropical Living Festival. And the purpose of this festival is to give the community an opportunity to see demonstrations and products that promote stability in our island home. There will be hands-on educational activities, local food vendors, and live entertainment by Berta Walta and the Kalapana Ava Band. It's free from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Arts and Sciences Center on Homestead Road in Pahoa.
And we have a combination book sale and Easter egg hunt. It's
I know.
It's getting to be that time of year.
Yes, sounds like fun. The Makiki Community Library is hosting a used book sale and Easter egg hunt. Registration for the Easter egg hunt is at 9 a.m., and it's for keiki up to age 12, and will run from 9 to 11 a.m. in Makiki District Park. The book sale is in the library, and that's from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tomorrow. The event is free, with free parking available on site.
Lots of good free things to do. Thanks a lot, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more about them on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Thanks very much for joining us this week on The Conversation. Coming up next week, we're going to debrief with Brad Glosserman of the Pacific Forum CSIS about the U.S.-China summit.
And we'll have a pictorial history of Maui's sugar industry.
Meanwhile, we'd like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line anytime you like. Here's the number, 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can also post comments on Facebook. Our page is Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'm at BKOZHPR.
And if you want to know more about the music you hear on the show, you can find our playlist on the page at hawaiipublicradio.org, which is also where you can listen again to today's or another show. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kosovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kosovich. Meet us on Monday when we pick up The Conversation. Enjoy your weekend.